populism. What is it really? And when we condemn it, are we missing the point?
The lesson of populism is a really, really simple one that we refuse as a nation, or as I should say, as a party, as the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party simply refuses to get to understand this lesson.
That's Thomas Frank, political analyst and author of such books as What's the Matter with Kansas and Listen Liberal, which we spoke to him about in 2017. Frank is working on a new book about populism. Then, Joe Biden's record in promoting policies that led to mass incarceration of black and brown Americans is coming under scrutiny. We play excerpts from a 2016 interview we did with historian Donna Murch about those policies and how centrist Democrats like Biden joined with racist Republicans to bring them about. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. We hear a lot about populism these days, but the populism that's being roundly condemned as the ideology of the right wing isn't the populism I studied about as a history major in college. That populism was a movement of black and white farmers after the Civil War who joined together to fight for social and economic justice. They created a third party, the Populist Party, when they felt that the Republican and Democratic parties weren't representing their interests. How did the name of such an important progressive movement get turned on its head by those who link it to right-wing racism and nationalism? I heard Thomas Frank talk about that very thing on a podcast recently, where he mentioned he's working on a book about populism. In 2018, he wrote a piece for The Guardian entitled "Forget Trump, Populism is the Cure, Not the Disease." Frank has been a guest on Writer's Voice before, so I called him up to shed some light on the subject. We also talked about the current presidential campaign and how some Democrats are promoting real populism against the fake populism of Trump. So, Thomas Frank, welcome back to Writer's Voice. I called you up because I heard you actually give a very interesting interview the other day about a topic that I've long been interested in, and that is populism and the faux populism that is, you know, termed today as populism. So I know you wrote a number of articles about this in 2016, which I'd like to go back to, but, you know, it certainly hasn't gone away.
Oh, my God, Francesca, it's worse than that. I've been writing about this since the 90s. This is the subject of my life, basically. And I'm working on another book about it, and hopefully this will be the last. I'll never have to write about it again.
And why is this the topic of your life?
Part of it is being from Kansas. So that's, you know, I grew up there, and that's Kansas was pretty much ground zero for populism. This is where the third party started. And it was the state where they were – it's a state where they did the best. They took over the state government and ran it for a number of years. So it's always been an important theme for me. And it's also – it's not just an important theme for me, Francesca. This is – I mean, since the 70s has been a you know, a sort of essential thread for understanding American politics. And the lesson of populism is a really, really simple one that we refuse – as a nation, or as I should say, as a party, as the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party simply refuses to get to understand this lesson.
And the lesson being, I mean, first of all, tell our listeners, what is that movement of populism that you started studying, the one that was there in Kansas and in other parts of the, you know, of the territories, really?
Well, it was a left-wing farmer movement, which sounds like there is no such thing anymore, right? There's not even a possibility for such a thing. But that's what it was. Farmers at the time were the single largest occupation, of course. It was something like 40 or 50% of the population. This is in the 1890s. I should have said at the beginning, this is in the 1890s that this happened. And in the years up till leading up to that, farmers had been – they're uniquely vulnerable to monopolies and powerful banks because farmers are a debtor class. I don't know if you know this, but they have to borrow all the time. They still do today. And they're also – because they're dispersed, you know, and there's millions of them and they're all over the country, they're vulnerable to monopoly. So railroad monopolies back in those days, today different monopolies that prey on farmers, whether you're talking about – you know, agribusiness, or you're talking about Walmart. They're vulnerable to monopoly, and they're vulnerable to banks. And they set up a group back then called the Farmers Alliance. It was like a farmers union, and started to come up with ways to fight back against the banks and the monopolies. And eventually, they decided that they couldn't do anything until they went into politics because the political system was so firmly controlled by the banks and the monopolies. And they did. And they went into politics, and that's when they took the name the People's Party. They decided to be a third party for complicated reasons. Well, it had to do with the North and the South. Both the two regions were single party regions, you might remember. So in one part of America, the Farmers Union, Farmers Alliance worked through the Democratic Party, and in another part they worked through the Republican Party, and they couldn't get anywhere. And they said, this is stupid. Let's start our own party. And that was the Populist Party. And they focused very, very closely on economic issues. And they weren't just farmers. So they also brought in a whole lot of other reformers. There were lots of different reform movements around in the late 19th century. And they also reached out to organized labor. Or not even organized, just workers in general. And in fact, they thought that there was a natural alliance between farmers and urban workers. So they, like the Knights of Labor, were part of this party and that kind of thing. And they, for a couple of years, they did really well. There was a serious depression in the early 1890s. And, you know, you might remember this is when some of the biggest, most wrenching strikes in our history took place. The Homestead Strike is one. The Pullman Strike is one. So all this stuff was going on, and the populists took the side of the strikers on these things. And they were getting more and more powerful, and they were doing better and better. And then in 1896, which is sort of the climactic year, it was a presidential election that year, to everyone's enormous surprise, the Democratic Party, meeting in Chicago, the Democratic Party basically embraced a part of the populist platform and fully embraced the sort of language of populism. And they wound up nominating this guy, William Jennings Bryan, who was from Nebraska, had spent a lot of time with the populists, and who talked like one. And this was an enormous shock to the nation. That such a man could be nominated by one of the two major political parties. He was 36 years old, and he was apparently an amazing orator.
The golden-tongued orator, I believe he was called.
Yeah, they wouldn't use that phrase. His symbol was silver. It's funny now to think about it, but a lot of the political issues back then boiled down to this battle over whether we should have a gold standard or a silver standard, which just seems like so, you know, who can imagine caring about that, you know? But it was a big deal at the time. And so the Democrats embraced silver, and the Republicans rallied behind their champion, William McKinley, and embraced the gold standard, stood up for the gold standard. And the Republicans, this was in a lot of ways the very beginnings of sort of 20th century politics. The Democrats tried to reach out to labor. They didn't really succeed. The Republicans, meanwhile, did a great job in campaign fundraising. This is the first time anybody did anything, any kind of modern fundraising, was McKinley. And they basically buried William Jennings Bryan. They outspent him something like 30-1 by this outrageous, you know, imbalance. Bryan went around the country, you know, on a train to spread his message, because that was the cheapest way, since the newspapers were almost 100% against him. And he had to carry his own bags. That always blows me away to realize that the guy is running for president of the United States and he's going around the country carrying his own bags. Anyhow, he lost. Long story short. And he lost, and the populists who had endorsed him, you know, they saw him as their chance, you know, their bid for national power. And they made their bid for national power, and they failed. And they fell apart, basically, after that, and they were never really heard from again. I mean, they declined, and then the Spanish-American War, which happened a few years later, really killed them. And that was the end of that was really the last big national third-party movement in this country. Anyhow, that was populism.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with political analyst and historian Thomas Frank about populism, real and fake. Right. And one of the key aspects of it that I always thought was important was that it united black and white farmers, at least in parts, and so different from the so-called populism of today, which is based so much on racism.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that the definition has been completely reversed? And it's actually kind of unusual that you even know that. I speak to audiences around the country all the time, and most of them don't know. They assume that populism was a racist movement. But actually, by the standards of the day, it was an anti-racist movement. They talked a lot about – this is in the South now. In the South, you know, this terrible racist system. You know, Reconstruction has ended, but in a lot of states, blacks still had the vote at that time. They were still able to vote. And the populists, one of the way that they, you know, what they came up with is their sort of singular appeal was, we're going to represent poor blacks and poor whites. You know, there was a Farmers Alliance and there was also a Black Farmers Alliance. And so there were a lot of black populists as well. And this was an incredible revolutionary thing that they said they were going to do this and then tried to follow through on it. Now, they did not succeed. They did try, and there were some states where they succeeded, like North Carolina. They managed to win. They managed to take over the state in alliance with the Republican Party, which was black voters were mainly aligned with the Republican Party in the South at that time. And so they succeeded here and there, but by and large, they did not succeed. But it was they tried, and that's the that apparently put such a scare into the Southern ruling class in the 1890s. And a lot of people have written about this. It's a really interesting story. But the populist effort to bring together poor blacks and poor whites was so frightening to the Southern ruling class that this is when you see in a lot of states the effort to disenfranchise black voters, you know, with literacy tests and poll taxes and, you know, the whole, you know, they used all of these different techniques to make it legal. You know, they would set up white primaries, this kind of thing. But they rallied around. They actually used the phrase white supremacy openly as a rallying cry to beat populism. You know, you can't vote for these guys. These guys are, you know, and it gets ugly. To do the research on this, it gets really ugly really fast. It's funny. I've never actually talked about this to audiences, and it's just some awful stuff. I mean, people were killing each other, and you know, it's a fascinating story. And what's really fascinating is that, you know, the story itself is fascinating, but the way we have misinterpreted it over the years is also fascinating. Where today, I mean, the New York Times, the, you know, leading newspaper of the English-speaking world, uses the word populist as a synonym for racist.
Right. And, you know, you call this populism's evil right-wing doppelganger. I mean, to me, when Trump got elected and I first started hearing the word populism being bandied around, it drove me up a wall because I actually, like you, I studied the history of populism in this country and had a completely different idea of what it is. So talk about, how did this faux populism first arise in the modern political era?
So this is a story that does not begin with Trump. It begins in the in the 60s with the governor of Alabama, George Wallace, who was the great sort of foe of the civil rights movement. You know, that was his police that were beating up protesters in Birmingham, et cetera, et cetera. His police on the bridge at Selma. He's the one that famously stood in the schoolhouse door at was it the University of Alabama? I don't remember the particulars, but he was a famous opponent of the civil rights movement. And in 1968, he decided that he needed to run for president. And he did it in kind of an interesting way. This is the beginning of the culture wars. Was in the late 60s, and Wallace was really kind of an inventive guy. Came up with all of these ways of expressing his frustration and anger with hippies, protesters, university professors, liberals in general. You know, now you remember it's not just the civil rights movement at the time; it's also the Vietnam War is going on, and so there's protests everywhere. Oh, and he also, of course, hated the news media. So you know how Trump likes to call out the news media in his rallies. He's lifting that directly from Wallace. In fact, so Wallace sort of pioneered what we think of today as the culture wars. And the Nixon campaign, the Nixon people were watching him in 1968. And here's another interesting thing: Wallace was a Democrat. And so Wallace had run in Democratic primaries and then ran as an independent in 1968. But he took away a lot of Democratic votes from Humphrey, and he also took away Republican votes. But basically, once the election was over, Nixon said, you know, this is the key to the politics of the future. They called it the Southern Strategy, that the Republican Party would basically steal Wallace's approach and use that as a way of flipping the South from being Democratic to being Republican. And Francesca, that strategy worked. And that's sort of the beginning of it, of the culture wars and all that. Now, it didn't get attached to right-wing economic doctrine until a little later. You know, you had Reagan come along in the early 1980s. And eventually what you see happening – and this is – by the way, I say this is the subject of my lifetime – you know, because I've written about it so many times, is what What's the Matter with Kansas is about. The right understood the power of this kind of populist approach, by which I mean they talked like working class people. They talk about culture war issues from a working class perspective. And yet they where they stand on the issues is always just remorselessly pro-corporate. Pro-big corporations. And Trump furnishes the perfect example. They called him the blue-collar billionaire at the Republican convention. And as I wrote at the time, it wasn't just his sort of his way of talking that earned him that title. He also was the man talked about the trade deals over the years that have been very – you know, that have really hurt working-class people. And he talked about these in a what appeared to be at first a very sympathetic manner. Now, he gets elected president. What's the first and basically the only thing he's managed to accomplish? Gigantic tax cuts and also deregulation, although he hasn't done that through Congress. He's done that through all of these executive actions, you know, all the this massive deregulation that he has done. He's done incredible favors for the corporate world. Now, these blue collar voters who fell for his act, you know, what's left for them? Well, I mean, look, unemployment is extremely low, and that means that wages have been going up. But that's not because Trump really cares about them or Trump has done anything for them. That's just a side effect of the economy running so hot, you know. But anyhow, Trump is a perfect case. But Reagan before him was also a perfect case, and so was George W. Bush. And we forget that all of these guys I don't forget, but all of these guys campaigned in the same way, tried to show their solidarity with middle America by using culture war issues. They would do anything for the working class as long as it didn't involve money, as long as it didn't involve anything real, you know? And That's also the story with my home state of Kansas, which swung wildly to the right in the 1980s and 1990s. You know, when I was growing up, it's always been a Republican state, but it was a different kind of Republican. It was a moderate to liberal kind of Republican.
It used to have great schools, for example, Kansas.
I went to them. I know that. And Nancy Kassenbaum was our senator, one of the last liberal Republicans. You know, Alf Landon was who was the governor who ran against Roosevelt in 1936. People don't know this, but he was actually in his heart was kind of a very liberal Republican. Dwight D. Eisenhower was from there. That was the sort of classic Kansas personality, political personality type. And all of a sudden in the 90s, those people started losing and were being replaced with this kind of Sam Brownback type, this very conservative, arch-conservative Republicans. And so the question of what's the matter with Kansas is how the hell did that happen? And it was the same thing. It was Republicans, or I should say the far right, figuring out how to use populist language while not meaning a word of it. And in the case of Kansas, the main issue that they did this with was the abortion issue. But there were several others. There was the theory of evolution. Jesus. Do you remember this? This is where the book started. This was the germ of it all. I was in Chicago. You know, I lived in Chicago at the time, and I was reading the newspaper one day, and there's this story about Kansas going to war against the theory of evolution, my home state. And I couldn't believe it. I was so ashamed. And I decided right then and there that I had to investigate. But all these roads lead back to populism, to these opportunistic right-wing politicians using populist language to win election.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. I'm talking with Thomas Frank about populism and about how the term has been appropriated by those who tie it to racism and nationalism instead of the biracial fight for economic justice the original populist movement in the U.S. promoted. Do you think it would have been as easy for them to pull the wool over working class voters' eyes if it hadn't been linked to the kind of right-wing cultural shift that you're talking about here with racism, but also, you know, the wars against women's health?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned the abortion issue, but racism is a huge part of this. Like I said, that's really where it began. You know, with George Wallace and the backlash against the civil rights movement. Now, what fascinated me about the Kansas story is that it wasn't a big part of the story there. That what makes the Kansas story significant is that it shows how this stuff can be, this right-wing populism can be secularized, if you will, can be taken away from the sort of its racist roots and become something else. But with Trump, you see, oh yeah, you see the racism and the bigotry in an enormous way.
You also, I mean, in the book that we talked with you about last on the show,
Listen Liberal,
you know, you really point out the other side of this, which is, you know, the Democratic Party getting away from being the party of the people and becoming the party of elites. And I'm thinking of Hillary's basket of deplorables.
Yeah, what a mistake that was. And what's fascinating, one of the things that's really interesting about that is Hillary knew, I think, almost as soon as the words left her mouth, what a terrible thing to say that had been, because that's blue collar people tend to be or are often very sensitive about, you know, about having lower status than everyone else. And to call them deplorable like that, I mean, even though she didn't mean all of them, they could hear that. They could see that that's what she meant. And Hillary, to her great credit, I think, realized what a mistake that was right away and tried to walk it back. What's fascinating, though, is that since she left the scene, the sort of liberal culture, especially here in a place like Washington, D.C., has doubled down on that in an enormous way, where that is the issue for them, is these, you know, these awful, rude, coarse, poor-mannered people who support Donald Trump, you know, and that we should make no effort to reach out to them. You know, what these people need is to be punished. You know, you're already talking about people who are very low status in our system, and it's crazy that that's our left party in America wants to hurt them even more. But that's where we are. Now, I should say, I understand a lot of the – I was just reading the newspaper before you called. I was reading remarks by one of the presidential candidates. I forget which one. And she said that it was a – or strongly implied, I should say, that it was – I should say that it was a mistake to reach out to voters in the Midwest. I'm from the Midwest. I think it's bizarre that a Democrat would that is someone from a major political party would say something like that. But I can also understand why they said it, because the last time this happened and the Democrats sort of tried to deal with the defection of the white working class was in the 90s. And the man who had the sort of solution to the problem was Bill Clinton. And do you remember what his solution was?
No.
He bid for the bigot vote with mass incarceration and welfare reform. That's how he did it. That's how he reached out to the white working class.
His southern strategy, in a way.
Yeah, his own southern strategy by bidding for the bigot. And I thought that was – I thought at the time I thought that was just loathsome. It made me so angry. And I forgot that anger, and it sort of resurfaced again in Listen Liberal, that really was – that was the Democratic answer to the Southern strategy. Was like, well, two can play at that game. It's like, really? That's your answer? So I can see why Democrats today are afraid of anyone who comes to them and says, you got to do something about, you know, these white working class people who fell for Trump's fake populism. But I'm here to tell you, the real answer to fake populism is not – bigotry. The answer to fake populism is real populism. I mean, the Franklin Roosevelt style, you know, real populism, the real deal. It wins.
Exactly. And that's what brings us to the other part of what I wanted to speak with you about, Thomas Frank, and that's Bernie Sanders. You know, it's actually a contradictory landscape we're looking at now, because at the same time that you have a lot of people in the Democratic Party scorning, quote, populists, unquote, as being, you know, this basket of deplorables, you also have them adopting Bernie Sanders' basically social democratic policies. Even if they are pretending to adopt them, they are paying lip service to them. That is where they do recognize at the basis. So I wonder if you could deconstruct this for us. You know, Sanders' position in the party, there's a lot of anger against him, but they're sure taking his points of view.
Yeah, that's because they can see that his ironically, they can see that his point of view is very popular with the Democratic base, with the people who vote in Democratic primaries. And it's amazing how far, in some ways, it's amazing how far we've come in just 3 short years, where, you know, 3 years ago, the Washington Post and everybody else was denouncing Sanders' healthcare proposal for, you know, any reason that they could come up with. But basically, it was irrational. It was pie in the sky. And also, it was an insult to Obamacare, which we should not insult because Obama got it done. And this is what he got us. And so we should be happy with it, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, none of it really is sticks together, you know, in a rational way. But they were throwing everything they could against Sanders. And they still are, by the way. They still can't stand the guy. But they're willing to sort of take his issues away from him. And, you know, that's often what happens with the, you know, with voices like Sanders. I mean, I already gave you an example of that earlier in this conversation, sort of an awful example of it was George Wallace, who never did get elected president, but everything he was saying is now, you know, Donald Trump, you know, it's all here. And that often, you often see that with people who mount these important campaigns for president, but don't themselves ever get elected president. But we'll see. I mean, Sanders is back in. He has a good chance. He's running very strong right now. I mean, we're way, you know, how long until the Iowa caucuses? 6 months, 7 months, 8 months? You know, it's a long time off from now.
Thomas Frank. We'll talk more with him about populism, real and fake, after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. They're free. Let's get back to my interview with Thomas Frank about populism and how progressives in the Democratic Party are promoting what Frank calls real populism to go against the fake populism of Donald Trump. I wonder if you could talk about Sanders and Warren as a now more embedded part of the Democratic Party, the erstwhile Party of the People that you've written about that became the Party of the Elites. What do you think is happening in the party, and do you see some hope for the future?
Yeah. So Sanders and Warren are very similar on policy matters. You know, they're very, very close. But there's one huge difference, and that is that Warren is Warren's a Democrat and has never made any bones about it. Sanders has always been difficult about identifying with the Democratic Party. Now, let's give Sanders some credit here. That means that he has been singularly open to listening to criticism of the Democratic Party. In fact, he criticizes the Democratic Party, and that's something that needs to happen, if you ask me. That's something that's very healthy, and I'm glad that he has done that over the years. I interviewed Sanders back in 2014, maybe 15, and he gave me a you know, it was a great interview, and he criticized the Democratic Party at some length in that interview. And I think the Democrats will, or the Democratic machinery will stop at nothing to make sure he does not get the nomination. That's just how they regard him. Now, that won't necessarily stop him, but I think that you'll see them pull out all the stops.
Well, he's created his own media machine as an end run around the Democratic dominated corporate media, let's say the MSNBC, also CNN. We're not even going to talk about Fox, because that's way on. Actually, Fox has been in some ways more open to him.
Yeah. By the way, can I tell you one of the weirder things that happened to me in 2016 was Republicans I would meet who really liked Bernie Sanders.
Oh, I had the same experience.
And I don't mean they weren't being disingenuous, like that's the guy we want to run against. No, they would have voted for him if he was the Democratic nominee. They really liked him. I thought about that a lot, Francesca, and I tried to understand why that was. And I think a lot of it is that Sanders is supposedly this incredible radical, but if you listen to what he's saying, he really isn't. What he is proposing is like Harry Truman's, you know, domestic program, you know, the Democratic platform circa 1948. And what's more, he has an accent from 1948. You know, it's like an accent right out of World War II movies. And so a lot of people, I think, they look at Sanders and they see him as a reassuring figure, not as a threatening or menacing or radical figure, but as a reassuring figure, you know, as a sort of continuation of something that, you know, that they approved of from long ago, which is, and you know what that is, of course, it's the New Deal, which eventually sort of was interrupted in the 1960s and has never really resumed since then. But that was something that was once overwhelmingly popular in this country. And Sanders, for whatever reason, enjoys the people who can remember things like that. He gets their support. That's my take on it. What do you think?
Well, I actually think he's got a huge amount of support among young people. We all know that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
who don't remember that time? And I saw a very interesting.
Well, I don't remember that time, and I like him. So,
I listened to the podcast "Hear the Burn" from the campaign. They did an internal poll of their supporters, you know, what is the main reason you would vote for Bernie Sanders? And by a huge margin, it was people trust him to be on their side. And I think that that's also what I experienced from the Republicans I know who said that they would vote for Bernie Sanders. If he had won in the primary, they would have voted for him for president. They felt he was authentic. He was real. He was on their side.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, that's for sure. And also, I'll tell you, I bring this up with people all the time. There is this huge sort of what we all know about the white working class people who left the Democrats to vote for Trump, former Obama supporters, whatever you want to call them. But as I would go around to union halls around America after the election, you know, I did the Listen Liberal came out in paperback and I spoke in some union halls and stuff like that. Those people loved Bernie Sanders. They really, really, really liked that guy. And these are unions where they would see, you know, 50% of their membership went out and voted for Trump because they really disliked Hillary in this just visceral way. But they really liked Bernie Sanders.
So what do you think of the Biden candidacy? I mean, do you feel, you know, many people have said, well, this is, you know, the same mistake as before. Other people say he's going to win the white working class. What's your sense?
I think he would have won if he had run in 2016. Had he been the nominee in 2016 running against Donald Trump, he would have easily defeated Trump. There's no question about that. But no, Joe Biden has a really charming personality. And, you know, I live here in Washington, D.C. I know people who know Biden, you know. This is a man that wants to be your friend. He wants to be friends with everybody. But his role in he has had a hand in some of the worst Democratic debacles of, you know, the last 20 years. In fact, whenever you find Democrats giving in on some incredibly awful Republican proposal, it always seems like Biden is right there, you know, if not leading the group. You know, I'm speaking of mass incarceration in the 90s. I'm thinking of the bankruptcy bill when George Bush was president, and you could probably find numerous others. These are terrible mistakes. And you know, say what you like about Bernie Sanders. You know, he hasn't changed his opinion in 30 years. You know, fair enough. But he never did that. You know, he never did stuff like that.
Yeah. So what about the support? You're from Kansas and you have your finger on the pulse. You know, this is something you've really thought about for a long time. Do you feel that it's going to be the Biden or the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party that is going to appeal more to those white working class voters? And let's be clear here. There are plenty of working class voters of color who are supporting Sanders and supporting Biden. So how about the working class in general?
Yeah. And by the way, that's a really important piece of the puzzle that we didn't discuss yet, which was that black turnout went way down in 2016. And obviously that has to be reversed if you're going to beat Donald Trump. So you have to – somebody has to be nominated who is exciting, you know, who can get working class people out of whatever race, can get them out, get them excited, get them, you know, happy to vote. Can Biden do it? I don't know. Probably. Look, Biden is Biden has this tendency for gaffes. I mean, literally anything can happen between now and the Iowa caucuses with this guy.
Thomas Frank. His book about populism will be coming out later this year or early next, and we'll have him back on the show to talk about it. He's a founder and editor of the journal The Baffler and the author of many books, including Listen Liberal, which we interviewed him about in 2017. Go to writersvoice.net to hear that interview. Next up, the bipartisan history of mass incarceration. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This show is being produced just before the first presidential debates with Joe Biden and other rivals for the Democratic nomination. Last week, Biden caused a firestorm of criticism when he extolled his relationships with segregationist senators like Strom Thurmond in, quote, getting things done. Some of those things he got done with them were anti-busing laws and the 1994 crime bill, which led to the mass incarceration of primarily black and brown people in the U.S. Biden defended the 1994 crime law in a 2016 interview, saying, by and large, what it really did is it restored American cities. But historian Donna Mertz says the crime bill devastated poor communities of color in cities. In 2016, we spoke with her about the bipartisan history of mass incarceration and the wars on drugs and gangs. Murch's essay, The Clintons' War on Drugs, When Black Lives Didn't Matter, appeared in the New Republic that year. You can hear the hour-long interview with Donna Murch on writersvoice.net, but here are some excerpts for today's show, starting out with this question. So tell us, how did the Democratic Party turn away from its roots and become the party that could allow the policies of mass incarceration and the war on welfare?
So I guess the short answer would be that the war on crime was bipartisan. There's no question that the new right that Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and George Bush were foundational in this. And the anxiety in the Democratic Party after the incorporation of African Americans into the Democratic Party, you have, you know, what Republicans called the creator of the strategy called this, Kevin Phillips, the Southern Strategy. So you have the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party couldn't be seated in 1964. But once African Americans are seated in 1968 in the Democratic Party, and we really do see kind of a important change, electoral changes in the structure of the Democratic Party. They develop a caucus system in order to make the party itself more responsible to different constituencies like African Americans and feminists, Hispanics. I would use the term Latino, but they use the term Hispanics. So they restructure the caucus system. So important changes did take place, and I think the Democratic Party did become more Democratic, small d. But at the same time, you begin to see the white outmigration from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party. And given that the African American population is roughly 10%, and Latino populations are much smaller in this period, you know, there was a sense of political crisis of we're losing our base. You know, the base of the Democratic Party had been white Southerners, you know, whites in the South, and then had been Northern working class urban populations. So there's a kind of a crisis that gets created where they're trying to recapture white voters. And I think that this helps increase what historians and social scientists have called dog whistle politics. And the most powerful one is crime. So you begin to talk about crime as a stand-in for talking about African Americans. And this started not after the urban rebellions, but going all the way back to the 1950s, that the Dixiecrats were always calling civil rights workers criminals. So the combination of that, the criminalization of civil rights, and then the criminalization of urban protests. So you have a series of urban rebellions that take place from Birmingham in 1963, really through the King assassination in 1968, in which hundreds of thousands of people participate. And the federal government's response to this is to pass the Omnibus Crime Control Bill. And these were essentially protests that were demanding that African Americans have access to social and economic rights. So there's a constant dance back and forth. On the one hand, trying to recapture the white vote, and this is true in the late 60s and early 70s, and it's certainly true in the 1990s. And on the other hand, it's the constant recourse to crime and symbolic politics as a way to represent race without directly naming it. One thing I wanted to add is that, you know, recently the wonderful journalist Dan Baum came out and was interviewed and talked about the statement by John Ehrlichman, one of Nixon's advisors, who said that we saw the real problems as blacks and anti-war protesters, but we couldn't make it illegal to be black and we couldn't make it illegal to protest against the war. So we decided that one of the best ways to fight these populations was to criminalize marijuana as a way to attack the anti-war movement and to criminalize heroin as a way to attack African Americans. And this is something that as a historian, that this is how I've always taught it. Of course, I'd read Dan Baum's book, which came out in 96. So I do think that the war on crime and the war on drugs were political projects that targeted specific communities. So to fast forward to the development of the Democratic Leadership Council, when I was asked by Liza Featherstone to write about the Clintons and the war on drugs, I started to go back and to think about this period that I had lived through and to think about the Democratic Leadership Council. And I had thought about initially the Democratic Leadership Council more generally as this shift right that happened in the 1980s. But when I went back and looked at the periodization, what I was struck by is that, as I mentioned, you have this overwhelming defeat in 1984. And so there's like a crisis within the Democratic Party, and they're trying to figure out what to do. So the first wave of new Democrats are led by Al Fromm, and you have a lot of Democrats coming from the kind of the Central South, coming from Oklahoma, from Virginia. And their primary interest is that they felt that the Democratic Party had become too beholden to these new constituencies, to its new caucus structure. So what they wanted to do was strengthen the power of elected officials within the Democratic National Committee itself and to bring it closer to corporate donors. So it really does start with an attempt to kind of bring big money into the Democratic Party. And it's part of, I would argue, a larger international problem of same thing happens in Britain with the Labour Party, of moving kind of corporate and moneyed interests closer to what historically had been Labour, Liberal-based parties. So that was the first wave of the DLC. Then what happens is that in 1988, you have a presidential campaign with Michael Dukakis running against George Bush. And you have, I think, our most notorious example of the use of dog whistle politics, where Michael Dukakis opposed the death penalty. And one of the things that Ronald Reagan did was, you know, you had a whole movement against the death penalty in the 1970s was to bring back the death penalty. And the death penalty had this deep symbolic racial politics. So, of course, if you think about it, it's state-sanctioned murder. And in a history like the United States, with a history of racial punishment, of lynching, that the death penalty was incredibly loaded because it was the ultimate expression of state power. And as we all know, overwhelmingly, it was used against African-American men. So the death penalty itself is very, very loaded. So essentially, Michael Dukakis, who is a liberal, he opposes the death penalty. And compared to the rest of the Democratic Party, he was relatively liberal on criminal justice reform. So there was a convicted felon who was released on a weekend furlough program. His name was Willie Horton. And after being released, he raped a white woman and assaulted her husband. And George H.W. Bush, his campaign manager, Lee Atwater, gets a hold of this and essentially uses it, starts running blitz campaign ads showing Willie Horton and essentially saying, this is what Michael Dukakis wants. Mm-hmm. And the consequence of this is that Dukakis, who had been ahead of George Bush in the polls and was actually quite popular, was defeated. And many historians have argued that George H.W. Bush was the first candidate elected fully on an anti-crime platform.
So Bill Clinton himself also embraced the death penalty.
That's right. So Dukakis is defeated, George Bush is elected, and I'd say this is where we see the second stage of the Democratic Leadership Council. So it starts with big money and trying to strengthen the power of elected officials, eliminate the caucus system. But after 88, it really accelerates, and this is where Bill Clinton becomes actively involved in this. Bill Clinton's own history as governor of Arkansas reflected this shift right. So in his first term as governor, he actually commuted in the 70s about 40 people from the death penalty, and he ran as a liberal. And he was defeated in his second election. And one of the major issues that was used against him was his liberal stance on the death penalty. So that defeat for him was a very bitter one, and he took it to heart. And after that, he commuted no more death sentences, and he took a much harsher stance on crime.
Let's talk about the 1994 crime bill. First, tell us a little bit about what the crime bill accomplished, if we can use that term, and why there was opposition to it, and what kind of opposition there was.
So the notorious crime bill, as it was called, its official title was the Violent Crime and Control and Law Enforcement Act. And essentially what it was a federal mandatory minimum law, but it contained many things. It was a federal three strikes bill that established a $30.2 billion crime trust fund to allocate monies for state and municipal police and prison expansion. So it was vastly expanding the amount of money the federal government was giving both for police and for prisons. It also helped to accelerate punitive policies at the local level. So the statistic that we often cite when talking about the Clinton's crime bill was that under the two terms of Bill Clinton's presidency, 600,000 people were put in prison. Now, the majority of those were put in prison at the state level. And of course, we can't hold the president responsible for state level incarceration. But what I would argue is that the kind of climate that was created, and this is true throughout the wars on crime and drugs, they they really, like Nixon's declaration of the first war on drugs, these were executive-sponsored policies where they were top-down policies that came and then flowed down into different portions of government. So the kind of extreme punitive rhetoric symbolized by the embrace of the death penalty, because another important part of the Violent Crime and Control Act is that it added 60 new different offenses, including nonviolent offenses, drug trafficking offenses, to federal law. And a number of people, I think 99 people were killed, were given the federal death penalty under the Clintons. So this was just a massive push forward for the mass incarceration state. And there's something else that I'd like to respond to. One of the criticisms that I got from my article was that the Clintons did not invent mass incarceration. And I would say that is absolutely true. The origins of mass incarceration lie in the mid-1970s, and they have earlier precedents, so there's a strong bipartisan element. But this is what I would say, is that like many state policies, mass incarceration was a process. It didn't just start one day. And if you look at it as a process, the most extreme acceleration in terms of number and punishment actually took place under a Democratic president. So I want to stress that mass incarceration was a process, and also the federalization of the war on gangs and the federalization of particularly the use of conspiracy and a whole kind of setting up these networks for the collaboration between municipal, state, and federal law enforcement under the Clinton era really helps to explain the huge numbers of people that we see in prison. It wasn't new, but it was an acceleration of degree that was quite profound.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're hearing excerpts from my 2016 interview with Rutgers University historian Donna Murch about the impact on communities of color of the 1994 crime bill that Joe Biden shepherded into existence and that was signed into law by President Bill Clinton. In 1993, Biden gave a speech pushing the crime bill where he warned of, quote, predators on our streets who were beyond the pale, unquote. I asked Donna Murch about the use of that kind of language in the so-called war on gangs.
A couple of things to say about this. First of all, the use of the term gang member. One of the things that happened in 1996 was the federalization of the war on gangs. And the war on gangs was a war on black people, a war on black youth. So I study, for example, Los Angeles, and as part of Los Angeles's war on gangs, by the early 90s, 47% of African-American men between the ages of 21 and 24 are designated by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department as gang members. So we are truly talking about mass incarceration. So there's the desire to represent essentially these monsters, the super predator, you know, the quote from Hillary Clinton about the super predator, as these exceptional, you can't even call them human beings, because what they're really doing is dehumanizing them and stripping them of humanity and making them into monsters. But what these policies really looked at on the ground were mass criminalization of black and brown youth, of Latino youth as well.
And what was the impact on black communities of this?
Oh, gosh. The impact is just devastating. I mean, I think we have yet to fully even reckon with its impact. There are people that have likened it to genocide, understood in the context of massive loss of family, of whole neighborhoods. Heather Thompson has written about million-dollar blocks where whole portions of blocks have been incarcerated, and that cost of incarceration per year is over $1 million a year. I can tell a short little story about that from my research, which really struck me. When I first started researching my new book on crack and the war on drugs, I was doing interviews in Oakland, which is home of the Black Panther Party. And Oakland has always been for me a very special place because of its real political vibrancy. It's such an important place for all kinds of radical politics, queer, black power, anti-capitalist, a variety of different types of radical politics. And I was interviewing one of the activists from the 1960s, and she told me about an event that happened in 2006 after Ron Dellums became mayor of Oakland. And Ron Dellums called in all of his old lieutenants, all these different political constituencies in Oakland, And they asked each group what they wanted. So you had business people, you had black city council people, you had some of the unions present. But they also invited a group of youth activists who were roughly late junior high, early high school, 14, 15 years old. And they asked them what they wanted. And they said that they wanted grief centers. And the adults in the room were really dumbfounded, and they asked them what they meant. And they said, well, you know, many of us have been raised by our grandparents. Large numbers of our parents have been incarcerated. Some have experienced addiction. And now our grandparents are passing. And we, before we could even begin to talk about what we want, we need a way to mourn. And I thought, I listened to that, I thought about that for years afterwards, that a whole generation of people really were denied their parents. So when we talk about 600,000 people being sent to prison, and that's only including prisons, not jails, which have, you know, an even larger percentage. So I think that it has been devastating at the most intimate level. You know, I think the separation between parent and child is probably the most important experience, part of the human experience. You know, Gil Scott-Heron has this song, "Who'll Pay Reparations on My Soul?" And when I think about that, family separation, that to me is most serious. But of course, there are many different aspects of things we can talk about. You know, in many ways, people are being stripped of legal citizenship, stripped of the right to vote, stripped of economic citizenship, stripped of the right to work in the legal economy. Because essentially, to have a felony conviction means that you can no longer work in the legal economy. It's very, very difficult. And of course, the public health crisis of prisons, you know, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, all different kinds of communicable diseases and HIV, the rates for infection are much, much higher. So being sentenced to prison has all these different implications, both of the most personal, but also public health ramifications.
That was Donna Murch talking with me in 2016 about the bipartisan push for mass incarceration and other policies that devastated poor communities of color in the U.S. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview. It's well worth it and still as relevant today as it was in 2016. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.